Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. My guests this hour are former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, Erica C. Barnett from the CIsForCrank.com, and Washington Policy Center's Paul Guppy. So happy to have you all here. Hey, everybody.
Hey.
Hey,
thank
Bill.
You.
Here's what happened this week. This, what you're about to hear, is not an angry British Parliament session. This is your House of Representatives and Speaker Paul Ryan.
House to be in order. The chair wishes to make an announcement regarding the decorum in the House chamber. The chair appreciates that members will differ on matters of policy and will seek to express those differences.
Some of the people presumably yelling there would be your Washington State Democrats, because all of your Democrats were in on this Democratic sit-in, stand-in, yell-in on the House floor. Jim McDermott, Susan DelBene, Adam Smith, Rick Larson, Derek Kilmer, Denny Heck. 100-plus Democrats took over and sat and stood and yelled, and the Republican majority shut off the House cameras so the Democrats and their supporters posted with their phones. NPR's Susan Davis says this is protest in the online age.
It is a new era in terms of how lawmakers protest on the floor of the House. It is not a new idea that the minority party has commandeered the floor, particularly when they're out of session, to drive a message. What was so remarkable about this debate is how they did it. Democrats used social media in a way that they have never done before to live stream these protests on Periscope, on Facebook Live. They Instagram, they took photos, all of which is violating the rules of the House. In some ways, it was an act of civil disobedience when it comes to how the House is governed. And this allowed them to create an audience for this message in a way that we've never seen before.
Erica, how should we feel about our congressional members breaking the rules and shutting down the House?
Well, I think if you're a Democrat, which I think a lot of KUOW listeners probably are.
I've never heard that before. It's interesting. Go on.
I think it's a promising sign that, you know, this is an issue, gun control, that rallies the base and gets them excited. But I would give a cautionary note to that, which is that this bill was over the terrorist watch list and making sure that people who are on that list cannot, on the no-fly list, cannot buy guns. That would not have prevented the shooting in Orlando. The shooter in Orlando was no longer on the no-fly list. And really, it targets Muslims. It targets people of color. There's a lot of people who are on there that shouldn't be on there, veterans, et cetera. So of all the gun control laws that I would want to personally see enacted as a proponent of gun control myself, that is not the one I would have targeted.
Don't those Democrats think that any gun control measure is good because it gets us used to regulating guns? Isn't that?
Yeah, so, that's the thinking.
Right? I mean the NRA is right about that, right?
I think it's literally them thinking this is the absolute. It's sort of like Merrick Garland being, you know, the most middle of the road possible nominee for the Supreme Court. This is the absolute most consensus-based gun control proposal you could ever put forward because it appeals to Republicans' desire to crack down on terrorism, and yet it still couldn't pass.
Paul Guppy, you used to work in Congress. How should we feel about our Congress members breaking the rules and shutting down the House?
Yeah, well, exactly that point makes me think that this might not work for the Democrats so well in the long term. So normally, protests and demonstrations are done by the people to send a message to governing elites. This is the first time I've heard of governing elites themselves having a demonstration inside the Congress. So it's yet to be determined whether that would be effective or not. It's certainly symbolic. It sends a message. One of the ironies, I think, is that perhaps the Democrats saw how Republicans had not listened to their base. And so then Eric Cantor lost his position, and then there was a revolt in the presidential primary, and that's how Donald Trump came along. So the Democrats are watching that happen with the Republicans, and it could be that they're thinking, we're not going to let that happen to us, so we are going to make sure that our base hears our message regarding what we're trying to do about gun control. So in that sense, I think it's effective as symbolism. Regarding actually changing policy, I don't think it's going to work. The House of Representatives is the most democratic institution in the government. It's directly representative of the people. If you have 218 votes, you can pass any bill or any measure. And they obviously fell well short of that. So they're not going to be able to pass a bill. But it did get a lot of attention, and they're using social media to get those images out. And I think that works, but I don't think it actually works to advance the cause that they're trying to support.
What do you think, Mike McGinn?
I think it's immensely important symbolically. It's certainly an escalation, but it's not the first time the floor of the House has been used for political theater. In fact, I'm going to date myself a little bit here, but when I was a young man working for Congressman Jim Weaver from Oregon, that was what Newt Gingrich did. He used special orders to give speeches to an empty chamber. The chamber was ordered to be, you know, to pan, the cameras panned the chamber. They ended up challenging Tip O'Neill on the floor of the House. Within a year or two later, Newt, who was a backbencher, led a walkout of the floor of the House of Representatives after a Democrat was seated over a Republican by 4 votes. And that was the rise of Newt Gingrich and the rise of the Republican Revolution was that type of symbolic actions on the floor. So the details of the bill, you know, I don't think are nearly as important as the symbolism of the moment. It is an escalation, undoubtedly. It's a sign of the deep divides we have right now. But as a Democrat, I'm kind of hoping that this is going to, you know, be as successful as Newt was, but in the right direction, not the wrong direction.
How do you feel about Erica's concerns that this is, yeah, it's symbolic and it's rabble-rousing and it's maybe trampling due process? Is that basically, Erica,
Those are great concerns to raise. They're appropriate concerns to raise in a democracy. But I think I personally believe it's swamped by the larger message of the Democrats standing up and fighting in a way that will resonate, I believe, deeply with the American people.
I think that my concern about that and about doing symbolic actions at this point is we have had so many mass shootings. While they were doing their demonstration, according to Vox, 88 people were shot in the U.S. And I mean, not just statistically, literally, that's how many people were shot during the sit-in. And so
does that count suicides?
I do not know. They were described as shootings, and many of them were mass shootings. I think there were 13 different shootings. So a lot of them were more than one person. I think in Chicago there were 13. There's a worry that the actual issue that we need to put some controls on people's access to guns and access to deadly assault weapons can get lost a little bit in the, you know, yay, the Democrats are winning symbolism. I personally think that what would be more effective than the no-fly list as a target, if we're going to pick a group of people, it's not Muslims, it's not the no-fly list, it's not people with mental illness, because frankly, you don't know that those people have a dangerous, violent mental illness until they act dangerously and violently, and you can't, I mean, profiling for that is not effective. What would be more effective is targeting people who have committed domestic violence, because that is the most predictive factor for mass shootings in the United States. If you look at the mass shootings that have happened, Omar Mateen, the Orlando shooter, would have been prevented by an anti-domestic violence act or, you know, of some sort of law preventing domestic violence perpetrators from getting guns. He would have been prevented from getting a gun. So would Robert Deer, the Planned Parenthood mass shooter in Colorado Springs. So 70% of mass shootings happen in the home. And so I think that's where we need to be looking, not at symbolic gestures like banning people from the no-fly list from getting guns.
Well, as I've said, I think the NRA fears and many Democrats, gun control advocates, hope that it's a one measure like this lead regarding terrorists and no-fly lists leads to other more and more gun regulation. Oh, we did this. Well, how about this? This makes sense. And maybe that gets to a domestic violence.
I hope so, but we're so far behind already that I think we need to take some pretty radical action at this point and stop talking and stop offering thoughts and prayers to people, because that doesn't work.
Well, I believe in prayer. I think it's a good thing. But what I would mention quickly is that there's I guess I would exercise a note of caution. And I notice there's role reversal in politics is always interesting, because to take away someone's civil rights because the government put them on a no-fly list seems to me to create due process problems. And if it were any other issue than firearms and guns, it seems to me that the ACLU, and it would be the left, who would be standing up and protecting people's individual rights. In this case, again, ironically, it's the NRA that's making the argument of protecting individual civil rights. And so I just think it's not so obvious.
And Erica just made that argument, didn't you?
Yeah, when the FBI puts you on a list.
The ACLU has fought very hard against the no-fly list, in fact.
So they have an argument. It's something to consider. Rather than passing a law which regulates firearms across the board equally for everyone, I just think we have to be cautious when when we get into the business of the government creating specialized lists. No due process, no conviction. They just say you're going on this list, and then your civil rights are less than someone else. And I'm not sure that's a good way to go.
Can I ask you guys about something different that this this made me think of? I'm going to play this one more time. This is the House of Representatives this week.
House to be in order. The chair wishes to make an announcement regarding the decorum in the House chamber.
Which made me think of Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
In Britain, and I wonder if you I realize we are non-experts here on international relations and finance, et cetera, but Paul raised his hand.
Volunteer.
Well, I'm kind of an expert, actually.
Yeah, well,
I just wondered your take on this British vote to exit the European Union.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me about parliamentary democracy, which I love parliaments. Mm. It's fascinating. My quick comment there is the rules of decorum in the U.S. House of Representatives are much more mismanners than they are in other governments around the country. And in the British Parliament and most other parliaments, you know, to yell at the other side and insult them is perfectly acceptable and happens all the time. But you were
I just wanted to go around and get any take on your take on the British vote, the Brexit, exiting the European Union.
Yeah, my quick take is that, again, it's a fascinating exercise in self-rule in democracy, because I read a comment in the Daily Telegraph newspaper where a British voter was leaving the polls and he was asked, you know, well, what'd you think about the vote? And the person wasn't even asked how they voted. They were just like, isn't this a hard issue to vote on? And the person's response was, this is how we get our freedom back. So obviously that person had voted to leave. But their sentiment, which was more of a gut feeling that the British majority anyway, feel that the EU was taking away their ability to govern their own country, I think was the fundamental driver. There were more immediate issues like immigration and jobs and economics that were on the surface. But I think the deeper concern for obviously millions of British citizens was they felt they were losing control of their country and they wanted to get that back.
And I think, well, yes, Mike, how did you react?
Well, first of all, that idea of just this nationalism and ethnocentrism in the vote was, of course, really troubling. We're seeing that in the U.S. I suspect that these economies and governments are so intertwined that actually unwinding them will take longer. And it's not like they jumped off a cliff.
No,
it's going to happen.
This will take years to unwind.
But it's also, I think, a really big deal. You look at Scotland now, they'll probably, you know, people are surmising they may vote for independence once again, which barely lost, so they can rejoin the EU. We here in Ireland, you know, should the Northern Ireland be reunited with the remainder of Ireland? So this obviously has, you know, kind of tectonic impacts.
But it's all far away fascinating, especially because we have this special relationship. You know, we share a language. But really, countries, they join, they don't join. Britain never used the euro. They weren't in the European Commission, the EEC. Remember that? They didn't like that. Switzerland's not in the EU. I mean, is it really that big a deal?
I think it is. And I think it is because of that. Because what we're seeing right now, there's displacement of populations around the globe, and some people will say it's politics. It's exacerbated a lot by climate change. It's exacerbated by inequality and colonialism. And the refugees heading for Europe, you know, the thousands of Somalis trying to board trucks to get through the channel to England. You know, over here we're saying build a wall. These global dislocations are having massive effects on governments around the world. This is a very big deal.
It's a reaction to things that are big deals.
But it's a big reaction, too, because, I mean, it's a question we have to ask ourselves in our country. You know, particularly we've seen the ruling from the Supreme Court. Are we, Seattle, going to be a place that welcomes people and is inclusive? Or are we are we about building walls? And this is the central question right now, it appears, for lots of places.
Yeah, it's a central question, and it's a central question in our, you know, in our presidential election, you know, to state the obvious. It concerns me, of course, to see this happen because our election is coming up so soon because Donald Trump's slogans and ideas echo the Britain First type of slogans and ideas. And I worry. And now we don't have the same. I mean, our immigrant dynamics here are very different. Our immigration dynamics are very different. But the ethnocentrism, the xenophobia that we see here is not that different. And what Donald Trump is expressing, I think, is, you know, tapping into the fears, into very similar fears here in the United States, that, you know, our jobs are being taken away, that our language is being taken away, with the "our," you know, always presumably being, you know, the white, you know, frankly, male, you know, party people in who have historically been in power. And we're not going to be a majority white nation for very much longer. Many states are no longer majority white. I think that's a good thing. Some people think otherwise. And you're seeing that sentiment, and hearing, as I've said on the show before, hearing Donald Trump say America first is very chilling. And it really echoes back to the 30s. And I personally find it very frightening.
So Donald Trump is a Nazi, you're saying?
Donald Trump is very similar to the people in the United States who used the exact same slogan, America first, and who were, yes, Nazi sympathizers like Lindbergh and Father Coughlin.
Well, the Brexit clearly echoes things that are big deals, and we'll see what actually comes from the years-long unwinding that is about to start happening.
I just wanted to throw in a quick word of defense for the average voter, that I don't think there's anything wrong with people wanting to govern themselves. And I think that's what a lot of this movement is about. It's not so much any particular issue of the day. I think it's a deeper feeling that people have, that people in the establishment of whatever race or gender are not listening to the average people. That was the message in the Eric Cantor race, where his career was just ended by the people in his constituency. And I think a lot of the people that support Trump, even though I don't agree with them, are trying to send a message to people in power that they haven't been listening. And I also think that that was part of the message in the British vote, too.
Finally, it did make me wonder whether we're wrong, because the pundits have been so wrong about Donald Trump's appeal, that it did pluck this string in me. Like, people will say one thing in public, and then when they actually have a chance to vote privately, it might be something else. So is there more sympathy with that? You know, things are changing too fast than we realize.
I take some hope in the fact that many of my Republican friends, and I do have Republican friends and family members, are not voting for Donald Trump. And a lot of them are voting for the Libertarian, whose name I cannot remember right now, but who is polling fairly well because there is a real Johnson.
That's what they say to you anyway, because you're polite company.
Oh, believe me, they tell me who they're voting for.
Private conversations.
They've never had any hesitation doing so in the past.
Okay, we'll watch.
I think there's something to that. If people feel that if their opinion is unpopular, they won't tell the pollster the direct answer, which is why balloting is private.
Yeah, I wonder. KUW's Week in Review, we're going to talk about how the Seattle area is growing and who's got a right to tell other cities how they should grow or not. We'll talk about allowing addicts to use in you call it a safe space, a wet space. We'll talk about that. And when it's okay for Sound Transit to advertise for itself. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. This conversation is happening in your ears and, of course, online. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. Please join us. I'm Bill Radke. I like that Carnation is a little town, because when we go to the pumpkin farm once a year, we like to drive past the horsies. That's about the amount of my stake in Carnation. But does anyone have the right to tell Carnation to stay quaint or stay small? This week, the Seattle Times reported on how the regional planning agency is telling Carnation and Duval and North Bend and Snoqualmie and Covington, telling them to stop building and growing so fast or else risk losing federal money. Paul, should this unelected regional planning board use the federal money it controls to pressure our little towns to stay little?
Well, interestingly, this might be a local example of these larger issues we were just talking about, because I'm a big believer in local small government, like letting people make their own decisions for their own community. I think that's important. But our circumstances here are unique in that this is a natural outgrowth of the 1990 Growth Management Act. And I just think that's something that we need to recognize, that these problems did not appear overnight.
What problems are you talking about?
The problems of where you can build, whether communities should grow, there's a no-build line. And all that was created over 25 years ago by legislation that was passed, and we're now beginning to see the effects of that kick in. So it's a matter of just recognizing that this is a long-term effect of a policy of restriction that the states started some time back. Also, in this area, it tends to be, and this is the frustration of people that live in these smaller communities, it tends to be dominated by Seattle. And as you pointed out, these unelected planning boards, no one knows who sits on them, and they make key decisions about your community. And so there's a lack of transparency there.
Erica, to you, this is about urban sprawl, right?
Yeah, it's about suburban and exurban sprawl. And when you say no one knows who sits on them, I assume you just mean nobody's aware because that information is public.
Because they're obscure government boards.
Okay.
They have a lot of power.
Well, then, I mean,
the same machine where you can follow us at KOW will also give you information about who's on the regional planning.
Yeah. And
they're not elected.
So they're not elected, but we do. But you're right, this has been policy since 1990 and since the 90s. And we have growth boundaries because sprawl is bad for the environment and because we want to preserve forest space for, you know, both for environmental purposes and, you know, frankly, for logging. So that is the policy that is in place. I feel like it's a slippery slope when you say that communities should be able to self-determine. I mean, you know, you go down that road and pretty soon, you know, I'm sitting in my house saying, well, why can't I have a coal-powered house?
I'm not arguing for anarchy. I just mean that
people should be able to
participate in governing their own community.
That's a result of a regulation that once did not exist and came into effect for reasons related to the environment, related to the collective good. And so we exist in a region and if we allow all these cities to sprawl as far as they want pretty soon, you know, they're going to be in the mountains.
Well, clarification, as I understand it, this is only an argument about inside the city limits of these small towns. Is that right?
Right.
They're not trying to sprawl out. They're trying to build within their own boundaries. And again, I'm not necessarily in favor of that. I'm just saying that it's more limited than sprawling across the countryside.
Well, I think that, some cities have done it right. I mean, I think, you know, the reason we're seeing, I mean, one reason we're seeing light rail or we're seeing buses, at least express buses, going out to places like Kirkland and Issaquah is because they made a decision that they're going to grow up and not out.
And they have transit centers.
And they have transit centers that exist there because that is planning. And you can't do planning on a city by city basis when you exist in a region. And in that region, the population center is Seattle. So, yes, it's going to be dominated by Seattle. That's representative democracy right there.
So then former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn, I guess you're used to telling other towns what to do, it sounds like.
They never listened. I actually sat on the PSRC as an elected official. It is composed of elected officials who adopt policies by vote.
But just not elected to that planning council.
Right, but it's not directly elected. That's
right.
Definitely true. I think this is a really interesting issue for a bunch of reasons. One is, and I apologize if I'm going to get wonky here, one is you have one set of rules, which are the zoning rules and the urban growth boundaries, and it is indeed true that all of these proposals are within the zoning and within the urban growth boundary. The problem is that they're exceeding the regional growth target set from above. So you've got these two sets of laws working against each other, which is not a good thing. Right. If you want a different type of building style, then build it into the zoning in the first place. And that's part of the fight. And I'll add one other little take. You know, I'm less troubled if these towns want to build some housing right in their, you know, traditional core. You know, they do have a downtown business district that might look like one of our neighborhood business districts. I think it's okay. And we can connect those in the future with buses. Maybe we can't get rail to everywhere, but we can connect them with buses. And a person could live a life where they could get from place to place without the impacts that Erica was concerned about. If in fact, we're talking about converting fields and good natural lands that are within the urban growth boundary, then maybe we ought to be taking a look at our zoning laws and urban growth boundaries. But I'm comfortable with the idea of allowing them to grow if they do so in a way that's economically productive and environmentally sensitive. I think this kind of top-down control troubles me a little bit because it doesn't work too well in the long run.
Well, the problem is, you know, a lot of the environmental impact isn't on fields or forests. It's on the region as a whole because of sprawl. And sprawl requires, you know, it's set up to require people to have cars. And cars are the largest contributor, or vehicles are the largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in our region. So if you're allowing communities to grow too much and their bedroom communities for Seattle, that has impacts not only on Seattle, but on the region's carbon emissions, on our contribution to climate change. And so population in and of itself can also be a problem when it's concentrated in those, you know, semi-rural suburban areas.
But that's the point I'm trying to make. If it's environmentally sensitive growth, and to me, I would define that as it within the walkable core of those places, and there's a bus line from the walkable core somewhere else, I would view that as a net positive, even if it did exceed the growth target. If it's a cul-de-sacs and a suburban style of development, then no, because buses don't serve cul-de-sacs well.
Well, have you been to Covington?
Yes, I have. I have been to these towns, and I understand. And when you get to the heart of them, there is a heart in these towns, even if they are surrounded by something else. And the demand and need for housing, and by the way, I think Seattle should do a little more of that too. We may get to that question of, you know, my neighborhood of Greenwood is on a bus line to downtown, and we could, you know, we got some parking lots we could turn into apartment buildings, and that'd be good for people who want to come here, speaking of including, not building walls.
Well, let's talk about that. We're going to talk about that after one more question, which is, are big cities telling little towns how to grow in part so they look green and pretty and idyllic and horsey-like and leafy for the benefit of people who don't live in those little towns?
Yeah, so that's always a problem is, you know, is some powerful political force someplace else turning my community into a museum because they have a vision for how I should live, but my neighbors and I might have a different vision. And I just think it's a matter of that kind of local participation.
I think you don't look like you're buying that, Eric.
Well, I think the planet also.
You like museums for people to live in.
No, I don't have any opinion about whether a place looks horsey or not. But although, you know, Black Diamond is very cute. But Enumclaw. But the fact is, you know, we can't have total self-determination in a world where we are all interconnected and where climate change affects all of us. So
sure. I'm not arguing for the Wild West here.
Okay.
I'm saying that I think people should be able to have more of a voice in what happens in their community.
Let's move to something Mike McGinn brought up, which is whether Seattle has all the green space we're going to get. This week, Seattle Weekly and the reporting project Investigate West told us how the city is selling off undeveloped land instead of turning it into parks, or at least keeping it as green space. Erica, you're not persuaded that the city is losing its open spaces?
Well, I wasn't persuaded by the premise of the argument of the article, because the premise, which it states up top, that Seattle is losing all its open space is false. It's just flat out false. And the peg for that was these Myers Way parcels in over in West Seattle. And they are unused parcels that have been up, you know, sort of the subject of possible development, not housing development, but that have been for sale off and on since 2003, I believe. So this is not a new story. It's not, and they're not pristine parkland. They're not, in fact, parkland at all. So the debate is, what happens to the space that isn't parkland? Will some of it become parkland? But meanwhile, Seattle has, you know, around the median amount of open space for a dense city. We have less per capita than a city like New York or San Francisco, which have, you know, big, large Central Park type areas. But on the other hand,
we could have had a Central Park.
We could have had a Central Park in the Commons, but we don't.
For those newbies, voters vote, you know, rejected a big, 60-acre park in South Lake Union.
Yeah, imagine how different South Lake Union would be right now, those who don't like it the way it's currently developing. But that's a 20-year-old story. Yeah. I don't buy the premise. And I think Seattle, compared to many, many cities, including, frankly, San Francisco, is a greener feeling city because we do a really good job of preserving our tree canopy, which is something I do very much support. So I think the panic principle of the article and the idea that we're paving over everything is ridiculous. I think the story also objects to what it calls pavement parks, which I assume is a term of art. I'm not sure, but also
known as parking lots with furniture.
Right. So that by that
does everybody know what these are? You're taking an intersection or a
a place that's totally unused, and it, you know, maybe just like overgrown grass, right. and turning it into a space that people can use.
Chairs, so, paint it. That kind
of. So sort of like Westlake Park. So if you think those are just parking lots with chairs, then, you know, by that token, it would be better to, you know, rip up Westlake Park, rip up Occidental Park, and put down grass. And
well, those
call
are
that,
those
call
are urban squares.
But they weren't. But they were made that way.
Like a traditional European type square. Well, but we're talking about neighborhood spaces.
They were made that way by people, and you know, and
because it's a dense downtown area. Well, but we're talking about neighborhoods where people live.
People actually do live downtown. But anyway, my point is that pavement parks are so-called are an improvement over, you know, over just an empty intersection that no one uses. People are actually able to use it. And then there are red herring. I mean, you're talking about these little tiny patches of ground that are improved slightly. This author, you know, says, well, that's not a real park like Discovery Park. Well, of course not. I mean, the like Lake Washington is not the Pacific Ocean either.
Okay. The bigger issue is Seattle doing enough to be green, to have green spaces, parks. McGinn, what are you chortling about over there?
A bunch of things. Yes, people do live downtown and people do live in First Hill. That was my first chortle. And that's been one of the biggest challenges, is how to give them parks and green space in places where land is very expensive. And that gets to the prioritization issue around this. So the fact that, you know, Myers Way, those parcels, you know, there's a group that wants that to be a park. That's a perfectly fine thing that they want, but there is a prioritization issue. And the city does have a plan to look at where's the priority. And part of the priorities just aren't on new parks, but the prioritization also of taking care of existing ones, you know, making sure existing green belts aren't overgrown with ivy, maintaining what we have. This city, you know, I ran a parks campaign before I was mayor. I voted for the last parks measure that came through. This city ranks pretty well overall in park space, but there are neighborhoods that need more. And so this is more of a prioritization issue about where we want parks and what types of parks. We got big parks, little parks, play fields, you know, waterfront parks. You know, is it more important that we get some street ends? You know, an acre of waterfront is worth a hell of a lot compared to 10 acres of woods in terms of how the public perceives and uses it. And this is what we all fight over. So I just think we go too far when we say, you know, when we take these two examples and reach a conclusion that we've given up on green space.
Okay, beyond these two examples, Paul, the city people keep saying we need more housing, so why prioritize saving open spaces?
Here, I'm the person who's skeptical of government power, and then I'm the one who's arguing for more green space. So my take on this is Seattle's proud legacy of having open green areas. So back in the industrial age in the 1890s, there was something called the Garden Cities Movement. It was a reaction to highly urbanized industrial eastern cities where they tried to get things like Central Park. And the great thing about Seattle is we've always been a garden city from the beginning. So it's not a case of where we had to take slum areas and try to create green areas. We've always had the green areas. And what's surprising to me about the article in the Times is that the city, which already owns public land, wants to sell it to developers. It's one thing to take public money and buy a piece of private land to turn it into a park, and I would be in favor of that. But this is a case where the city already has real estate assets that are publicly owned, and it's just a matter of making them more available to the public or not selling them to a for-profit developer to build apartment buildings. And I think that's entirely reasonable. And with all of the density and crowding that's happening in the city now, I think it's even more important to preserve the open spaces that we already have.
Want to answer that before we move, Erica?
Well, I'm scrolling through my notes here to see if they are being built, turned into apartment buildings. I don't believe that's what the plan was.
Well, some kind of private development.
Yeah. So again,
which means they wouldn't be
like
available
Mike
to
McGinn
the community
just said,
anymore.
I'm going to actually call you out. Please stop interrupting me so much.
You spoke for quite some time, a few minutes ago. So
okay.
Take turns.
We all. It's sort of hard to when you have something to say, and do you wait until someone's moved on?
Right.
But we don't want to interrupt each other too.
Yeah, so I've managed
we all appreciate
to write things down to just to wait my turn.
Yes.
As Mike McGinn said, this is a matter of prioritization, and the city does have to make a profit from, or at least not take a bath when it sells land. I don't know all the details of this deal. I know that it's been in the works, that the city's been trying to offload this land for almost 15 years now, at least. I don't know that every single piece of city land would its highest and best use would be parkland. I can't believe that is true in every case. So And again, I just took issue with the sort of panicked tone of the story, because in Seattle, we actually are doing pretty well on green space.
Okay, let's talk about a way to deal with people who are homeless and addicted. And also, when does your local transit agency cross the line when it comes to telling you how terrific its service is? Stay tuned. KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Mike McGinn and Paul Guppy and Erica C. Barnett. Here is another way Seattle could deal with homelessness. Some homeless people are addicted to alcohol and other drugs, and the city could set up a place, maybe multiple places, where people can drink, shoot, use illegal drugs, with staffers there allowing it and trying to help those people. Paul, should we help addicted people use drugs in this supported way?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I deeply think that the world needs more kindness. And I don't think it's kind to sponsor and facilitate someone's destructive habit. I think they should be supported towards recovery. If I had a friend of mine who was an alcoholic and he said, "Hey, run down to the liquor store and, you know, pick up my booze," I would say, "No, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to help you hurt yourself. If you want to make a decision to get better, I'm behind you 100%. You have all my support." But I would not actually sponsor and facilitate an activity which is clearly hurting that person. And that's just on a personal basis. And I think it gets even worse when it's a matter of public policy, where the city government says, on behalf of the community, we're going to help you, you know, engage in your addiction. And I think there's a real problem with that.
Erica, why would the government do that?
The government would do that through the principles of harm reduction, which is based on the fact, not the idea, but the fact that some people are not ready to get well. And some people can greatly be, their life, you know, expectancy and their quality of life can greatly be improved through harm reduction principles, including not dying of an overdose. One thing that has been conclusively proven at the safe injection site that exists in Vancouver, BC, is that it prevents people from dying. They have never had anybody die of an overdose in their facility in the 10 years that they've been in existence. So there's that. I mean, people can't get well if they're dead. The other fact is that people who have safe consumption spaces aren't getting into other trouble, like violating, you know, public drinking laws, violating laws against using drugs in public. They aren't getting thrown in jail, which does decrease your quality of life, because you have, you know, like, say you're homeless and you have all these, you have tickets piling up for public consumption that you can't pay, that you go to court, that you end up in jail over and over again. So, I mean, the basic principle behind it, behind harm reduction, is better is better. And if people aren't going to get 100% better, as we define it as policymakers, which I believe is pretty much everybody should just abstain if they're using, which I don't necessarily buy either. If they're not going to do that, we got to do something. And I think that keeping people safe in a space where they have access to services, where they have access to treatment, where they actually can get into a better path for themselves, is an improvement over what we're doing now.
Okay, so I hear both of you saying we want to be kind. So then the question is, what's the best way to do that? Mike?
I'm all for it, what's being proposed. And I think we need more all-day shelters. I think the principle of harm reduction, it's the principle behind our law enforcement assisted diversion program, that arresting low-level drug users and sending them to jail is a lot more expensive and a lot worse for us than directing them to treatment. And we've gotten national attention for this. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, we say we don't want people on the street. We say we don't want them on the street shooting up, using drugs. We don't want them on the street publicly drunk. We can't also then say we're not going to figure out how to accommodate it in indoors, if that will make it easier to reach them and get them services, help them get their feet underneath them. And we know those things to be true from data. That's just not pulled out of my head or somebody else's head. We know it. And harm reduction's a real thing. The reality is there's a lot of bad things happening in our city. And if we're going to take this, you can't do it here, you can't do it there, and you can't do it there, that just doesn't work. We have to figure out how to reduce the amount of harm that these individuals are engaged in, and be partners in that, not simply be exacerbating it.
So, Paul, you're outnumbered. You're hearing you, and you know the arguments.
I knew I was outnumbered when I came into the studio.
Oh, okay. But so, how do you answer those concerns? We all have those concerns. We're all trying to make a balance. This is a balance.
Sure.
This is an imperfect choice that we're all trying to make. You heard arguments about cost, about overdoses, about people landing in jail. I'll give you another chance.
Oh, sure. I think it's really about the best way to show concern for people, because the previous comments of my friends here is that based on the assumption that there is some set population of addicts and abusers and that doesn't change, whereas this is actually a dynamic situation in society where drug abuse is a widespread problem. And so when the government sends a signal that it's okay to come to an approved facility and be sponsored in getting high, I don't call that harm reduction. That seems like facilitating someone harming themselves.
But how do you know that? How it's that signal, it doesn't feel right, and it feels like it can't end well, but how do you document that?
Well, I'm just going by what seems right to me, is that when the public sends a signal that it's okay to get high, you're going to have more people doing it. So, in other words, the population of people who are engaged in this activity could increase. And if the government is encouraging it, it sends a signal that it's at some level is okay. Also, this idea of kind of, storing people away where they can, get drunk and not interfere with someone else is also, I think, overlooking the problem to some degree.
We have that now. It's called houses.
So I agree that just arresting people then sending them to jail and then they go around in a cycle doesn't work. What does work is getting people into treatment and sending a very strong signal that you need to get well and that there are resources and public health and counseling and treatment to help people do that. But I don't think we should go so far as actually sponsoring people's addictions.
Okay, let's stick there then. Erica, does this kind of harm reduction, safe space, as you're calling it, does that get people into treatment?
It does get people into treatment. And
does it reduce the population of people who are engaged in this?
In Vancouver, it has, and particularly the population that they serve, which are homeless people. I would point out that quote-unquote warehousing, or I can't remember the term you used, but putting people into a space where they are sanctioned to get drunk already exists for housed people. Housed people can go into their homes. They can also go into their homes and get high. So these primarily
private.
Serve...
That's not... I'm sorry to interrupt. There's a difference between public and private.
I understand that there's a difference. Right. And I'm saying that I also want to go back to the idea that this feels wrong. It may feel wrong based on your personal experience and political beliefs, but the fact is that data shows it works in getting people into treatment. Not that there's enough treatment. I mean, if we said everyone, we're going to force every addict in the city into treatment today, we would have a waiting list decades long because we don't have treatment for everybody. So in the absence of that, we have decided in this society that we don't care enough about people who want to go to treatment, who want to get better, to actually fund that. So that's our priority as a society. We don't care about that. So are we also going to say we don't care about whether they die on the streets, or are we going to say we're going to create a space where they won't die and where we can, get them into a pathway toward housing if they're not housed, a pathway toward treatment if they want treatment, and a pathway to not get hepatitis and HIV because they have safe needles to use. I mean, that syringe exchanges have been around since the 90s. They were very controversial at the time, too, because they were said to be enabling. And the fact is that syringe exchanges have saved countless numbers of lives through people who have not contracted deadly diseases. And they were just as controversial as safe consumption. And I don't think it's been borne out that they have somehow contributed to, an overwhelming epidemic of needle injection drug users. What happens is these things go in waves and... it's heroin right now. It's going to be meth next, or something else. And then it'll be heroin again.
So we won't solve this now. But Paul, if you could wave your wand, would you agree then? Yes, ideal would be actual spots and staff and money to treat people.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that we're not spending now.
Right. So we should put our public resources into that because that's what helps people towards a cure. That makes them sound human beings. to say that needle exchanges have been around for 20 or 25 years, and yet addictive drugs are as bad as ever. So that hasn't led to a solution. And I think we clearly need more services in mental health for drug addiction. But I don't think that we should tell people that the government is going to sponsor their drug habit or even give them free needles. I don't think that's a good message.
Okay, we can only press pause because there's much more to say. Sorry, Mike, because we have so much more to talk about. Like Sound Transit 3, I'm going to play you a jingle in a moment. With you, learning from this week's news, are Erica C. Barnett, Mike McGinn, and Paul Guppy, and I'm Bill Radke. Our local governments want people to ride mass transit, but it gets tricky when our governments spend taxpayer money to promote mass transit. This week, KUOW's investigative reporter John Ryan looked into the money Sound Transit spent on a light rail station launch party and to advertise its transit network.
It's real money. People have worked hard to pay the taxes, and it should be going into service.
The agency's plan is to saturate the region with advertising, so most commuters will see a Sound Transit ad at least 50 times this year. That includes social media, newspaper ads, and underwriting on KUOW. PHMIA doesn't dispute that transit agencies should spend money to draw people out of their cars and onto buses and trains.
This is an unreasonable amount of money. If you've got a good product, you don't need to be spending that much money to sell it.
Jeff Patrick is one of Sound Transit's spokespeople.
When we're going to take the time to advertise, we want to have it at a volume that is going to make a difference. And we have some pretty good evidence our advertising works because we're seeing such high ridership gains in comparison to other regions.
Patrick couldn't say just how much of those ridership gains are due to advertising.
Now, government agencies are allowed to advertise themselves, but you should also know who's paying for the message. KUOW found that 83% of the money raised by the committee supporting Sound Transit 3, the ballot measure, money that pays for Sound Transit's advertising, comes from a handful of companies that have each done at least $2 million in business with Sound Transit and unions representing members who work on Sound Transit projects. Again, nothing illegal or even unusual about that. What would break the rules would be Sound Transit trying to influence the election. So what about this Sound Transit video you're about to hear? Is this election campaigning?
Folks, we got ourselves a little problem in the area. I think you can relate to what it is. Our traffic's a mess, and here's the deal. Too many people behind the wheel. The region is growing in leaps and bounds. Like honking horns, get used to those sounds. By the year 2040, you're ready to gasp? 1 million more people, and that's hard to grasp. But we're Sound Transit, and we've got a plan, as well as an attitude of, yes, we can. Mass Transit gives choices, and since we're being candid, it's flexible, which means it can be expanded. So think about this heading home tonight. When you let us drive, there's no traffic to fight. On light rail, you'll relax, kick back, no stress. If you're thinking, should you try it? Just say yes.
Just say yes. Does that sound like Sound Transit's trying to influence an election? Well, it sounded that way to the State Public Disclosure Commission when KUOW played it for them, especially this little part.
Mass Transit gives choices, and since we're being candid, it's flexible, which means it can be expanded.
The head of the Public Disclosure Commission said, quote, "It may be an advertisement for increasing funding through the ballot measure." The commission told Sound Transit to take that off of YouTube. So, Erica, should we hold public agencies spend money to tell you what they're doing and why you should use their service? So should we hold this spending against Sound Transit?
Well, I have to say, if that's a campaign ad, it's a pretty poor one. Although it did get me to listen for the full, was that a whole minute?
That was a minute. Yeah.
Wow. It felt like longer.
Ouch.
I do think that though, going back to Jeff Patrick, the Sound Transit, spokesman's comment, I do think, advertising does have to be loud for even whether it's for a business or a public agency.
And you have to saturate the market to get people to hear it. That's a marketing truism.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to my dad the other day, and he was talking about a guy who was on the airwaves selling mattresses back in Houston when I was a kid, and he's still on the airwaves. And everybody knows him. And, you know, it's almost like you – I mean, I wouldn't necessarily remember an ad if I heard it once. If I heard it five times, I might. If I heard it 10 times, I definitely would. So – I think that the proof is in their success. When they opened, they were, I can't remember, something like 15,000 writers over their expectations. They've been consistently, you know, over 50,000 writers on a weekday. That's way over what they projected. And I think you have to give advertising some of the credit for that, because people have to know that, you know, this is an option, and they're not going to know if you don't advertise. I mean, they're not just going to stumble upon a light rail station one day and decide to go down and see what's going on down there.
Well, look, it's ma'am again. What do you think?
Well, I think if Sound Transit paid money for that, they should ask for their money back. Then maybe that would, you know, make people a little happier.
Ouch.
But, yeah, ouch. But
you guys make it sound like it's supposed to be easy.
It's not easy. And of course, they have to advertise for riders. And of course, they have to communicate with the public. But of course, they're a huge government agency. And this is what happens. And people should be on the lookout for it. They're going to walk right up to the line using public money to build goodwill for what they're doing. And I love light rail, but we should look at that with skepticism, at the same skepticism we look at WashDOT, you know, with its, you know, all of the money they spend on consultants and third parties to push for highway projects. We should look at it at any government agency that's using public money to try to generate goodwill. But there is a line, of course, and people are going to walk up to it and occasionally cross it. And they also have a duty to communicate. So where exactly is that line? Who knows? But a free press and lively political debate can help keep it in check. At least we can hope that.
Okay. Well, Paul, you're next. We are going to have a yes-no decision here on the ballot. My question was, should we hold that their spending against Sound Transit
in
November?
I'm going to vote for it.
Okay.
But I do think that Sound Transit, if they're going to get criticized for edging it too close to that line or crossing it, they deserve the criticism if they get it.
Paul Guppy.
Yes, shockingly, I agree with a lot of what you just said. So I think that's right, that we should be careful of powerful public agencies who are spending public money to promote themselves. I mean, as a thought experiment, I thought to myself, well, would we think it's so great if the Defense Department were doing ads like, hey, our last war was a great one. That came out great. Let's do it again. And so I would just be suspicious of that kind of use. Also,
that happens, doesn't it? That's like presidents on aircraft carriers.
Well, yeah, I mean,
mission
accomplished.
Mission
is what
accomplished.
Bush did. But as far as a government agency having a publicity campaign and advertising, I'm always concerned about government agencies using public money to promote themselves. So we have to watch out for that. I would be in favor of taking Sound Transit's advertising budget and giving it to mental health. I think that would be a better use of it. And we also have to be sensitive to the fact that Sound Transit is funded with regressive taxes that really fall heavily on working families. And so this is the way they're spending their money. I think that it's not a good use of funds. And I do think that they're trying to influence the vote coming up in the fall.
Erica, we have a minute before we pull into our destination.
Sound Transit is funded by regressive taxes because the state legislature made it so. Now, as far as this comparing this to the Defense Department, Sound Transit is a consumer agency that relies on fares for some of its money. If it doesn't sell things, you know, whether it be widgets or Link Light Rail tickets and passes, it's not going to be as successful. And conservatives are going to be angry that its fare ratio isn't high enough. So, you know, I think we wouldn't get mad at a business for advertising its products. And, you know, I mean, I think we should definitely hold them to a higher level of scrutiny than a business because we pay for them. But I think advertising to sell a product is perfectly legitimate.
I think Sound Transit member Claudia Balducci is coming on the show in a week, right? Producer Amina Al-Sadi. Yeah. So she'll get to defend that decision.
make her use that voice the whole time.
The entire show next week will be conducted like this. Highest ratings ever. Mike McGinn, Paul Guppy, Erica C. Barnett, thank you for being our Week in Review this week.
Thank you.
Thank you
for tuning in. We're Facebook, KOW Public Radio. We're live tweeting at KOW.